This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, we are airing a panel discussion that looks at Utah's opioid epidemic and explores potential solutions in addressing the problem. For context, according to the Centers for Disease Control in 2016, more than 63,000 people died from drug overdoses around the country, and nearly two-thirds of those deaths involved a prescription or illicit opioid. That same year in Utah, 635 people died from drug overdose. Several Utah counties are suing drug manufacturers over opioid deaths, and the state of Utah is also looking at its own lawsuit or settlement with pharmaceutical companies. Today's panel was recorded earlier this year on April 3rd at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. It features moderator, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, and panelists Adam Cohen, CEO of Odyssey House of Utah, Dr. Jennifer Plum, Medical Director of Utah Naloxone, and Angela Stander Lowe, Opioid Overdose Prevention Coordinator at the Utah Department of Health. Here's Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox.
Let's jump right in and just start talking a little bit about the opioid epidemic. I want to talk first a little bit about the history of this epidemic. Kind of, where did it start? We're hearing a lot about it now. Is this a brand new thing? Something that's been around forever and we're just now learning about it? Let's just talk about the history and maybe specifically where Utah fits in this and why it's maybe even worse here in Utah.
So, no, this is not a new concept, unfortunately. I can speak from experience. I lost my brother to a heroin overdose in 1996, right here in Salt Lake City. So this has been here even longer than that, but we've really started to hear about it more so in the last 5 years as the death rates have increased dramatically, as every single person we know has someone in their family, in their neighborhood, a friend, a loved one, an associate of some sort that's been impacted by this. And as the rates have gone up, we're starting to finally talk about it more. It likely was started, and there have been ups and downs with substance use patterns, period, through the decades. But it likely, this most recent incarnation, really ramped up in the 1990s with a couple of things happening. One being that there was a large push from pharmaceutical industries to get the quote-unquote non-addictive opiate, OxyContin, onto the market. As we all know now, there is no such thing as a non-addictive opiate, but that's how it was pushed. That's how it was marketed. And physicians wrote a lot of prescriptions, and Americans asked for a lot of prescriptions, and this started the prescription portion. At the same time, unfortunately, there was a cartel effort of illicit heroin coming into places like Utah, a swath across middle America, where they targeted, like they would any other business, targeted places where they thought there would be good uptake. So throughout the 90s, we had a ramping up of prescribing, and we had a ramping up of people expecting and wanting opioids on the prescription side. And then at the same time, we had illicit heroin being brought in almost in a pizza delivery fashion in the way that it's described. It would be, you'd text a number and it would arrive at your house. And so we had a lot of folks that were being exposed a couple of different ways, unfortunately. And as the years and now decades have gone on, the demand for opioids has continued to increase. And anytime you have a demand, Americans are really good, and American industry is really good at a supply. And so as that demand's gone up, the supply has continued. Unfortunately, like you referenced and Angela can attest to, Utah has been in dire straits. We've been, in 2014, we were fourth in the nation for opioid overdose deaths. 2015, we were seventh in the nation for opioid overdose deaths, which is unfortunate and also really sometimes hard to figure out because we're not a high substance use population in general in our state, with a lot of our rural communities. So to give you an idea, that the figures I use, the national average is probably somewhere between 16 to 18 per 100,000 deaths. Utah is around 23 per 100,000 deaths. Some of our counties, some of them are even worse than those 40. Some of them are in the 50 to 60 range, four times the national average. The good news is I think we're starting to really address things. We've really gotten programs to get people aware of this problem, to save lives with naloxone, to start getting treatment options available, but it's still absolutely terrible.
Yeah, just to kind of piggyback what Dr. Plum said, so our where the numbers are at right now, so from 2002 to 2014, we saw a 400% increase in opioid overdose deaths. As Jen talked about, as we started to prescribe more in the mid-1990s, we started to, of course, see increase in opioid-dependent folks, people getting addicted, and overdose deaths as well. So we do know that There's some promising things going on. In 2015, we saw the first drop, a small drop, about 11% in our prescription opioid deaths. That's your RX opioid deaths, but we are still seeing an increase. As those decrease, we see an increase in your illicit heroin deaths. So we do know that there's a lot to be done there still, and also sometimes a lot of the efforts have some backlash effects too, and that could be the case. When we talk about prescribing, we're the 15th highest prescribing state in our nation, so we are higher prescribers here. So we've done a lot of work to try and understand why that is. We know that there's a lot with perceptions of Utahns. There's a lot of perception, if it comes from our doctor, that it's safe, and understanding that those who are misusing or abusing these types of medications in their home, that they're in just as much danger as someone who's using illicit heroin. But getting people to understand that connection or see those dangers has been difficult.
One thing to go back a little bit further than the OxyContin being non-addictive, also doctors have been earlier in the 90s and in the 80s adding the fourth vital sign, which is pain. And so we as a culture have become less tolerant of any type of pain. And so doctors are asking, how's your pain? And they more freely prescribe what they thought was non-addictive, and then here we are.
Not only was it that added as the fifth vital sign, reimbursement was tied to it. So, for example, Medicaid and Medicare funding, physicians and healthcare providers and clinicians would have to ask with all of your other, here's my pulse, here's my blood pressure, here's my respiratory rate, here's my temperature. So those are objective measures, right? Any clinician can objectively measure those. Now we're going to add in this fifth pain score, which is a subjective measure, and I certainly don't advocate for anyone's suffering or anyone's pain not being addressed, but you can't quite put that the same as a number that you measure, you know, up on a clock or with a blood pressure cuff. And physicians, hospitals, healthcare agencies, they would be audited, and there would be a determination of, did you address your patient's pain scales and pain scores enough? If you didn't, you forfeited funding. So it was very much built into this whole kind of development. And again, I don't advocate for anyone to suffer, but I do think that it's very challenging when perhaps a pharmaceutical industry is driving the sale and the utilization of their products based on something other than just that pain. There was a lot more incentive than just making sure people were not in pain.
So this is kind of the elephant in the room, right? You said something when you were first talking about what we thought at the time was non-addictive, or what we were told at the time was non-addictive pain meds. We know that's not true today. Did we really not know that then? What do we know?
We knew that then.
Right?
Okay. We knew that then. I mean, I think that, and it's such an interesting, society does this, medicine certainly does this, we swing the pendulum too far, right? And from the clinicians I've talked to that were around in the 70s and the 80s, you know, there was a big terror about opiates, largely from folks coming back from Vietnam, dependent on substances that they had been exposed to there. And they didn't prescribe enough. And unfortunately, what happened was we did neglect taking care of pain in some of the patients that really needed it, especially end-of-life pain, cancer pain, hospice pain. We really didn't take care of people's pain well enough. So then the pendulum swung way too far the other way, and the pharmaceutical companies were there ready to say, guess what we've got for you? The data that they used, data, and I use that term very loosely, to justify saying it was non-addictive was a two-paragraph letter to the editor in a medical journal to say that it was non-addictive and non-dependence creating. So we knew. Unfortunately, I think we all would like to think there is a not-addictive opiate, and we can't be so lucky. We can't have it both ways.
That doesn't exist.
And yeah, it just isn't a thing, right? The memes these days, it just isn't a thing.
Right.
So, you know, though, it's also, before it sounds too much like I'm throwing my colleagues in medicine under the bus, we as Americans also had a very strange expectation that there would be a pill for everything, right? That there would be no pain, there would be no discomfort, there would be no condition for which there would not be a pill. Look at it now. I mean, you've got every single thing you can imagine there's a pill for. And that was a really unfortunate combination that, you know, Americans wanted it and pharmaceutical companies were promoting it and doctors went, okay. You look in some European countries and African countries, they straight up do not prescribe opiates. They do not prescribe opioids. I'm aware of a urologist, a physician who practiced in Salt Lake City here for quite a long time, treating painful conditions, kidney stones, vasectomies, nephrectomies, where you pull a kidney out, pretty painful things. And then moved over to Europe into Switzerland and said, I have not prescribed one single dose of opiates since I've been here. Same conditions, likely the same pain. I don't think that Swiss folks are differently inclined to feel pain proprioception than we are, but there's a different expectation here, and there's a whole kind of, I think, evaluation of what it means to be comfortable in life, and that pain also, your body is telling you something's wrong if you have pain. We should probably listen to that. Your body's telling you, hold up, ease up, don't do this, don't do that. That's going to take decades, though, to kind of reformulate in people's minds, I think.
Right. Thank you. Angela, talk a little bit about this cultural piece. We know Utah's a little different, at least historically. It was interesting. You mentioned that we went from fourth to seventh, right, at one point. That isn't because we got better. It's because the rest of the country kind of caught up to
Absolutely,
us a little bit.
Yeah.
But Angela, you also mentioned the difference between prescribed narcotics and the opioids that people are illicit that are getting on the street. I'm interested in the culture of Utah and maybe why we're a higher prescribing state, but I'm also interested. I think it's always fascinating those that make the leap from the prescribed narcotics to the illicit narcotics and what it takes to do that. We know it's gotten cheaper as the drug cartels have come in and made that more available, but you didn't hear that much about heroin on the streets in the 80s and 90s. I mean, you read about it in the news, but it wasn't it wasn't something we saw. Now down in Rio Grande, you know, I've been down there and I've seen people down there who, you know, were very successful, had a knee surgery, and now they're living on the streets. So can you talk a little bit more
about
that?
Absolutely. So we've done a lot to try and delve in and understand not only the public and why they're perceiving this the way they are, but also the providers and the barriers that they're facing, because we can't put it all on them as well. We've done a lot in our state recently with public awareness to try and meet them halfway and try and have that patient in their office be the one starting that conversation as well and saying, hey, I know these are dangerous, because physicians face a lot of barriers like patient backlash and the way that the culture's gone to be high prescribers. So talking a little bit about that culture as well, anytime we have it high prescribed, like Jen talked about, we have increased access. We know that about 75% of those who misuse or abuse opioids or who stated that they got them from a family member or friend. So whether that was through sharing or just simply they're accessible, they're everywhere. We're not asking to completely be in pain, but a lot of times when you have a procedure that is painful, you're prescribed a lot more than you need. And that usually ends up in a cupboard or even purposely holding on to it, thinking I might need that again sometime in the future. So we've become a society that kind of thinks, oh yeah, I'm going to hold on to that, or I need all 30 or 60 of those that are prescribed, when really all I needed was two or four to get me through the weekend. So talking about that shift to heroin, we see that in a lot of ways. We hear that story over and over again of how it started out with an injury and the person got addicted to these. And the way that happens is through physical dependence. And physical dependence is something that kind of turns into addiction. And then a lot of people, we know that 80% of heroin users stated that they started out as a prescription opioid, being addicted to prescribed opioids. So we do know that a large percent made that shift because of access and because of price, but also understanding how difficult of a disease addiction is, and especially opioid addiction. I mean, physical dependency, if you guys think about, oh, I have a Diet Coke or my Starbucks addiction, and you kind of joke about it, but really you know that if you're not having that, you're getting headaches, and that kind of it's really cramping your style. And opioid addiction is like that to a way higher degree. So we know that as people start to use these to treat legitimate conditions, that they start to become physically dependent. They start to need it. And if they're not going to get that through their source that they started out and became dependent on that with, they're going to seek other sources that are easier, such as heroin and other things.
Well, and just to give you an idea, what the street value for an OxyContin is about $1 a milligram is what you hear. Actually, larger, higher prices. So an 80 milligram OxyContin goes for about $80 on the streets downtown Salt Lake. It's about $120 in price for that same pill. And a balloon of heroin is between $5 to $10. So when people are in this position where they're physically dependent on a substance, people a lot of times who've been dependent on opioids for a long time, there's a misperception that they're using to get high, or they're using, you know, recreationally, this is fun, when in reality what they're doing is just trying not to be sick, to keep using, to take away that awful withdrawal symptom. And so people do get to the point where, boy, whatever you can get access to is really paramount to them. And it's an unfortunate reality that, as you know, it's hard because we're doing, I think, the right things in medicine to discourage prescribing and to keep numbers, you know, to get only appropriate prescribing and conservative prescribing and hopefully smarter prescribing. But if we do that in a way that we just cut people off of these substances who've been on them for years to decades without getting them medication-assisted treatment options, counseling options, recovery and rehab options, therapy options, guess what the next step is, unfortunately. So we have a long ways to go. One, to start acknowledging these problems, two, to then next step say identify the people who need this help, but don't just identify them, then get them help, which is, you know, the realm that you work in, Adam, that is a huge problem. There are a lot of people that would not like to be in the situation that they are with opioids, but they can't get help. And guess what that means, unfortunately.
Yeah. Adam, let's talk a little bit more about what you do for the audience. Explain what Odyssey House is, what you do, kind of how it works, and what you're seeing.
Sure. So Odyssey House is a nonprofit behavioral health care organization serving Utah. We have a full continuum of care ranging from high-intensity residential services to all the way to outpatient and early intervention services for adults, adolescents, and mothers with children and fathers with children. We also have a primary care setting that's integrated with behavioral health care. So we are focusing on mental health and substance use disorders in a primary care setting, and then service-supported transitional housing. So one of the things that Odyssey House focuses on is global lifestyle change. So what we're going for is not just stabilization of mental health conditions and abstinence from drugs and alcohol, but also focusing on the key components that are for long-term success. So talking about affordable and safe housing, accessing appropriate healthcare, managing chronic conditions, and then finally education and vocational training. So people need to have jobs, and that's a huge self-esteem boost for people who are getting into recovery. Is I have a stable house, I have a stable, I've stabilized my health conditions, and I've also have a good paying job.
That's Adam Cohen, CEO of Odyssey House of Utah. And thanks for tuning in to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel discussion recorded earlier this year on April 3rd, taking a look at Utah's opioid epidemic. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a panel discussion recorded earlier this year on April 3rd that looked at the impact of the opioid epidemic on the state of Utah, with a special focus on efforts to combat overdose deaths. The conversation was moderated by Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, and panelists including Adam Cohen of Odyssey House of Utah, Dr. Jennifer Plum of Utah Naloxone, and Angela Stander Lowe from the Utah Department of Health. Here's Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox.
I want to talk a little bit about solutions moving forward, but before we get there, can we talk some more about the demographics of who are these people? And you mentioned earlier, Doctor, that I think all of us in this room know someone in our family or at least someone we know who has been through an addiction or is currently addicted to opioids. I know in my family, that's the case. And I like to joke, this was back in the early 80s when a close family member had a very serious addiction. I like to joke that, you know, we were addicted to opioids before it was cool, you know, before it was a thing. But it has been around for a long time. And let's talk about the demographics here in Utah and nationally. Who is being impacted and the rates of that? And any of you can jump in on that.
Well, before we even start talking about it, I'll ask each of you, picture in your head, so we know the rates that they are in Utah right now. We're losing at least one person every single day to an opioid overdose, so maybe 10 people a week or so. So that means there's a funeral today and a funeral tomorrow, and someone's planning a funeral for the weekend. Picture in your head who you think that person being buried today is. I won't take a poll. I'm not going to grade anyone on this, but I'll tell you, I screw it up every time. I picture, probably related to my experience with my brother, but I picture a 22-year-old male, maybe shiftless, maybe reckless, maybe homeless, maybe jobless. You know, you can picture the kid I picture, right? Well, I don't know how many of you pictured similar to that. It's not my brother. It's me. It's 45 to 54-year-old women. 2/3 of our deaths in this state are related to prescription opioids. The number one demographic for deaths within the prescription opioids are 45 to 54-year-old women. And I don't say that to make it saying, like, if it's me, if it looks like me, it must clearly be a more valuable life. We must have to care harder about it. No, I just say that to put it out there that it isn't who you think it is. It isn't just those reckless young males. Now, in fairness, and when it comes to heroin overdose deaths, it is more largely a younger and a more male population, more that kind of 19 to 34-year range. But it isn't what people think it is. And I will tell you, from working in the emergency department at Primary Children's, the number of children that are impacted by accidental overdoses because these pills are in so many of our homes would mortify you. I had one shift in the ER, just my personal shift, my patients I took care of, where I had 4 kids under 4 in the ER, 4 homes, all at the same time, overdosed on opiates. So the demographic is not what Utah has kind of traditionally thought of. Like I said, oh, it's those people down at Rio Grande. Why are we throwing resources at those people? Which, again, to me, those people matter as much as anyone. But the reality is, when we say those people, what you mean is, you mean me. You mean your aunt. You mean a 4-year-old in your neighbor's house. You mean a 60-year-old gentleman who's on cancer pain meds. You mean. So the demographic is not what people think. And I think that's really important as we move forward with these dialogues, because it's very easy to say, oh, those people are every single one of us and every single representation of society.
And I couldn't agree more about that. It really is our mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers. And I think we oftentimes think that it's the Rio Grande population or the homeless population. And it's not the case. The people who present for admission into treatment services with us and other providers, they look much like us. They really are all of us. And so one of the things that I think is really important is that opioid addiction, the addiction deteriorates very quickly. So people are, you know, have good jobs, have housing, are doing quite well, and then they lose everything in a very short amount of time, and then they are the people at Rio Grande. And so those people were us not that long ago.
And I think the most common thing with all those people we talked about is all of them said this, the idea of that was so far out of reach. They all said, that will never be me. I think everyone starts out thinking that that's not something, the perceived threat is just the biggest issue.
I've never met a patient that said, I want to be a heroin addict. I've never met somebody who said, I want to shoot heroin every day. And Jen's right. I mean, at the stage that we're seeing them, it's not getting high and having a good time. It's so that they don't get sick. I mean, it's that desperate for them.
And I think it's the choice thing is really interesting, too, when we bring in the prescription opioids part of it, because you can develop physical dependence on these substances in as little as 7 days. And any time that someone has had a trauma or a surgical procedure or childbirth, even a painful procedure period or painful experience in life, and they're given opiates, I'll give you a common example of a hip replacement. Almost everyone that gets a hip replacement gets 30 days worth of opiates, meaning you take 1 to 2 every 4 to 6 hours for those 30 days. I will guarantee you, any one of us in this room, any one of us up here, takes 1 to 2 pills every 4 to 6 hours for 30 days. Day 31 will feel like the worst withdrawal any other opiate user would ever feel. It is, these substances will do that to anyone. And so there has to be, you know, a reframing. If something comes in a little brown bottle prescribed by your doctor and dispensed by your pharmacist, it's nice, right? It's not naughty. That's nice. Now, if it's in a syringe and you cook it in a spoon, boy, that's naughty. This brown bottle thing is nice. And we've missed that dialogue. Both physicians, pharmacists, and public figures or society members, we've missed it. I mean, I advocate now, as much as I want docs to have smarter prescribing, I want every single patient to say, anytime one of those prescriptions is written to them, do you really think I need this? These are pretty strong medicines. Do you think ibuprofen or Tylenol might work for me? What about physical therapy and or massage? I've even heard acupuncture and like, we have to start advocating for ourselves and for our family members, because 7 days, I'm telling you, 7 days. And that won't happen with everyone, but it will certainly happen with a large percentage of people who end up in this realm at risk of death, needing recovery services and support services, because they did that one morally reprehensible things. They followed their doctor's orders, right? Because in this world, it's really easy for people to say, guess they shouldn't have used drugs. Okay. We can go down a whole lot of paths talking about that, but what if that decision they made when they chose to use drugs was to follow what their doctor and their pharmacist, two of our most trusted institutions and entities, set to do? And then they found themselves 14, 30, 60 days later, can't believe that, like you said, that they're that person. Like, we really have to change the way that we think about this, because this is not as simple as your choice to party really screwed you up, didn't it? It's not that at all.
Thank you. I do want to talk about some of the solutions, right? There are a host of solutions that have been proposed. Some of them may work, some of them may not work. You know, we talk about the way we prescribe, and some of the unintended consequences of that is forcing people now onto the streets, which may be even worse. And so there can be those unintended consequences. But let's talk about what we can do, or maybe what we are doing, what we've seen so far, how it's working, if other states are doing things better, what kind of recommendations you would have for policymakers, legislators, those that are passing laws, doctors. We just want to open it up and talk about real solutions. So go ahead, Angela.
Yeah, I'll start with a few things we've done. Like we said, I think we can't just blame doctors. They're one of the most well-intended, probably, professions, I would say, for sure. So what we've done is try to understand what barriers they're facing, and then meet them there and provide them tools. So some things that have passed that are great, we've created opioid prescribing guidelines, and then we've done our best to help them to implement those. The controlled substance database is where they can track what their patient has been prescribed, and we've done a lot to provide dashboards to kind of alert them and say, hey, this patient is high risk for addiction or high risk for overdose because they're prescribed a number of other opioids or other medications such as a benzodiazepine that could create an issue. We've also done a lot of trying to educate them to screen and assess their patient. Like we said, everyone's at risk for addiction. Really, it's everyone. But there are some higher risk factors. And if we just started that conversation, if we talked about that and said, hey, do you have substance abuse issues or mental health disorders or other physical ailments that might increase your chance of becoming addicted or experience an opioid overdose if I prescribe you this? So those are some of the big things we've done. And then also, the last thing I'll speak to, and then these guys can talk about other great policies that have gone forth. We're really happy with the way that some of the legislation has gone the last few sessions, and big things have happened. One that happened this last session is something we tried to push prior to it being passed as well, but that's that piece of the pharmacist. We talk a lot about the public and providers prescribing, but we know that the last touch, the last piece of education a customer can receive is from that pharmacist sitting at home. So we have created some educational materials that will go home, and that pharmacists are now required to have that additional conversation with their patient who they dispense an opioid to and tell them about these risks. We know through focus groups that while most Utahns obviously know about the dangers of opioids, they hear about it all the time, but majority of them, and most of you might not know the common opioids. So we've done a lot to educate. Hey, your common opioids are Percocet, Lortab, Vicodin, generic names such as oxycodone, hydrocodone, things such as this, putting pill bottles, stickers on the top of pill bottles, alerting them, hey, this is an opioid, this is what everyone's talking about. And a lot of times, that's all it takes is just that initial conversation, either with your doctor or pharmacist or with a family member or friend.
Thank you.
I think the one thing that really needs to be addressed is physician and provider education on warning signs of what to look for, and so that they can intervene earlier on. And so what we've really made a mistake policy-wise is that we've missed when it's more easily treatable, and then it becomes so much more expensive, and lives are lost, and families are shattered because we've let it go for much too long. So having that conversation with your provider, but also having that conversation with your family member when you are starting to see warning signs, so really getting that kind of education out in the community as widely available as possible. I think one thing that is really unique to this epidemic is that there are highly effective medications that go along, that really work quite well, and really no other drug has the type of array of medications that really do help. And it ranges from opioid replacement therapies to blockers to all types of different things. And we have a unique opportunity to really harness the data that's out there and use that as providers. Not just in behavioral health care, but in a primary care setting, and prescribing that as a replacement to that. So
I couldn't agree more. I think that screening is huge, and not just even screening for trouble, but screening every patient. You know, we launched a program with the American Academy of Pediatrics where we got ESPERT, which is screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment, put in with 22 different pediatrics groups, so that you started asking the questions with even kids as young as about alcohol, about tobacco, about pills, about other substances. We should be, in my opinion, doing that in primary care too, with every single patient, rather than looking for, seems like a couple things in your life have gone the wrong way. What's, you know, rather than, like you said, trying to pick up the pieces, why not identify someone at the very beginning and try to get them services, try to get them perhaps redirected? And there have been some legislations passed that required, for example, ESPERT training, and for physicians as part of our DOPPEL licensing, you will need to do the training. But then we need to take the next steps and actually be doing it in our practices and doing it in our clinics. Utah has had tremendously successful naloxone legislation. I'm so proud of what our state, our legislators, are, all of us working in kind of literally, it is the greatest little collaboration of everyone you can imagine to try to save lives. We probably have the top 1, 2, or 3, I would say, most liability protective and encouraging naloxone laws, which, for any of you who haven't heard, naloxone is the opiate antagonist or reversal drug. So if someone overdoses, they're not breathing when on opiate, you want to get them breathing. To me, first responder means first person there. First responder used to just mean EMTs or paramedics or even ER doc kind of sitting. In my mind, first responder means first person there. And so we've gotten naloxone into thousands of homes across this state, both through pharmacies and through direct outreach and through providers and through programs, every way we can possibly get it to people to save lives. And that's not to say that naloxone is by any means a fix, because it's not. It's a fire extinguisher that essentially puts the fire out so you can keep someone alive, because you can't get better if you're dead. We have to keep these folks alive so they can get on to the next best steps. And I think that the kind of the model that's been set forth in the opioid crisis here in Utah with naloxone is what we need to move forward with on these others. You know, health departments and recovery community and physicians and pharmacists and direct street outreach providers and law enforcement. Putting these kits directly into people's hands is exactly what we need to do with these other. We need to talk screening in all of these environments. We need to talk treatment access in all of these environments. It needs to be all of us, not just, oh, they're the treatment guys and she's the public health guy, oh, and she's the naloxone lady. Like, that's, we need to bring kind of more of a global sense in, I think. And I think too, we need more information. I think, you know, opioid fatality review boards, something where we can actually look at who has died, when did they start, where did they get their last prescription or whatever from, where did we miss opportunities to intervene and save this person's life before they got to that point. And I think there are some great strategies moving forward, but there's still obviously a lot of work to be done, and funding.
Yeah.
That, there's the other elephant in the room. Nobody wants to fund something that we don't have funds for, right? We have got to start funding mental health. We have got to start funding recovery and addiction resources. I lost my father to cancer, and we must have spent millions and millions, and his insurance company must have spent millions and millions of dollars, and nobody ever batted an eye at it. When my brother was battling addiction, they covered him once, and then after that, you better take out a second on your home, or you better sell your car, or you better find a way. That's not okay. There needs to be parity in the way we treat physical health and mental health, and we're not doing it.
So I wanted to finish, and then we'll open it up here. And I'm not even sure how to ask this question, Jen. You kind of touched on it. There are two pieces to what I want to get at, and it's this concept of, you know, the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff versus right. The fence at the top of the cliff, right? We've talked a lot about the ambulance at the bottom, what we do there and how we treat it. So you brought up mental health. We've talked about how opioids are used in physical situation that then leads to an addiction of some sort. But we also know that these drugs make you feel better about life in general, not just the pain you have in your knee or your hip, but they make a lot of your problems go away. And so there's definitely a mental health piece to this. And that idea of review boards, kind of figuring out how they started and why they started and where we got there. But again, culturally, societally, and there's maybe not an answer to this, but how do we do a better job of putting that fence up at the top of the cliff? Any additional thoughts or final thoughts before we open it up there?
I think acknowledging that the mental health most of the time there's a mental health condition underlying when we're treating an addiction. So they're self-medicating, numbing themselves from some emotional pain. So it's not. We need to be addressing that. But I think from a funding standpoint, just going back to that, the healthcare system has looked at addiction in the wrong light. And it's an acute episode that can be fixed in 15 or 30 days. And that's just really not that's not the case. It's a chronic disease that needs to be treated like a chronic disease. So you wouldn't say to a diabetic that you get 15 days of counseling and then you're done and you're fixed. No, this is something that you're going to need to address most likely for your entire life. And so the healthcare system needs to change how they are paying for these services. I think one thing that is going extraordinarily well in Utah and really is finally, I think legislators and elected officials are really wanting to invest in treatment because it makes financial sense because they're costing the emergency departments a hell of a lot of money. They're costing jails and prisons a heck of a lot of money. So this is really not just the humane thing, but it's also the right financial incentive to do that. And so I think we're getting there on a public official standpoint, but the healthcare system needs to change how they look at this problem.
Thanks. Other thoughts?
Well, primary prevention is essentially, you know, kind of the fence at the top of the cliff instead of the ambulance at the bottom. And there are a lot of strategies, I think, that are going to take tough dialogues. You know, Utah has not always been a state that is the most open to talking to our kids about things that are the dialogue over what the conversation should happen at home and what conversation should happen in school are challenging. Well, if we're going to start talking about primary prevention, we've got to educate our kids. And it isn't just say no campaign. It is a here is reality. Here is what is out there. I've had so many kids tell me in the emergency department setting, as well as out in school outreach settings, as well as on the streets with kiddos who've ended up there, unfortunately, I just never would have believed that brown bottle would have gotten me here. Or, oh no, I don't snort or smoke or inject heroin, I just take pills. Like, this kind of baseline knowledge, we have got to change the way that that is. And that, I think of it, I'm obviously a little bit pediatric centered, I think of it from the kids, but probably from all of us. And I think that we do need to get, likely somewhere in there is the mental health piece about how life is rough. Life is painful at times, life is awful at times. And the solution isn't always going to be a pill. And it's definitely never for mental pain going to be an opiate, never. but we have prescribed and people have wanted a pain pill for mentally painful conditions over a lot of years. So I think for me, where we really have to start is we've got to get these dialogues out. There's no one program we can put in every school and every setting and get people finally to think about prevention, but we can get people changing the way they think if they have dialogues. Let's dialogue about this stuff. Let's talk about this stuff. Let's bring it out of the closet where it's been for far too long in this state, and let's just get real about what's happening.
I like that, and that's what we're trying to do today.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's
exactly.
Great.
You were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Stay with us. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today we are airing a panel discussion recorded earlier this year on April 3rd at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, taking a look at the opioid epidemic on the state of Utah with a special focus on efforts to combat overdose deaths. The panelists include Adam Cohen, CEO of Odyssey House of Utah, Dr. Jennifer Plum, Medical Director of Utah Naloxone, and Angela Stander-Lowe, Opioid Overdose Prevention Coordinator at the Utah Department of Health. And the conversation was moderated by Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience.
Hi, Jen. A question for you that hasn't come up yet. What's the role of syringe exchange programs in addressing opioids?
Yeah, syringe exchange legislation, I will tell you personally, took years and years and over decades to get through in this state, having been someone who early on in the 2000s tried, and then we tried again, and then we tried again, and then we... Luckily, in 2016, we were able to get syringe exchange legislation passed. And syringe exchange, also called needle exchange sometimes, is hugely important in this realm for a couple of reasons. One, the disease prevention aspect. People who inject drugs with syringes are at risk of infections like hepatitis C, of infections like HIV, and also of bloodborne infections, so bacteria in the blood that can get in your heart and can get in your brain. So providing clean syringes, as was shown in the 80s and 90s with the HIV epidemic, is a tremendous public health disease prevention aspect. Okay, that's one piece of it. The second piece of it is that when you engage with people who actively inject drugs and talk to them about their health and talk to them about how you actually care, you don't want them to get sicker. They're already dealing with the dependence and addiction and substance use piece that they're in. You don't want them to get sicker with a physical piece. You want to provide them with resources. You want to provide them with naloxone so that if they or someone around them overdoses, they're equipped. You want to provide them with referrals to treatment. You want to provide them with referrals to services that can help them. So in the 6 months that I worked in needle exchange directly, what I found was, yeah, there were some people who maybe didn't care much about recovery at first. But after six times in, when you talked to them every Friday and you'd seen them use a naloxone kit and they told you about how they saved their girlfriend's life and they told you how nice it was not to have to worry about that needle that they found on the street that they were injecting into their body, that it might give them HIV, that they started to see that their life had value and that somebody did actually care, that they didn't die and that they didn't end up with these awful, expensive conditions. So for me, needle exchange, although it is in some people's first kind of perception of it, seems like you're empowering and enabling people to do something we don't want them to do, it's a tremendous opportunity to get people resources to save their lives and to help them get on the path to sobriety.
Thanks. Let's go next. Yes, please.
Hi. This one also is for you, Jen, because you're on the opiate task force. If you all want to chime in, that would be wonderful as well. But before I ask my question, I do have a little bit of preface to it. So I can't remember if it was Spain or Portugal, but one of those countries had 2% of their population addicted to heroin. And through decriminalizing heroin and providing the best of best treatment programs that they could, their heroin crisis just disappeared because people were
Portugal.
Able.
Portugal.
Yeah,
yeah,
it was Portugal.
Portugal.
Yeah, it's Portugal.
Thank you. So people were able to seek treatment, and there wasn't necessarily a social stigma surrounding it because there wasn't that thought of, oh, if I go to a rehab center, I'm going to go to jail. So my question is we know now at this point that treating prisons as a forced detox center isn't really the way to go because people aren't given the tools to necessarily deal with those addictions properly. What are the chances that we're actually going to see the legislator next year put policies forth that are more focused on treatment than criminalization?
odds. She's asking me to put odds on this.
I'd say the odds are very low, but go. Yeah.
I was going to say, I didn't want to say zero, but I think the focus is the key. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think let's acknowledge first that there have been efforts to do that, not in the same way that Portugal has, but the Justice Reinvestment Initiative yeah. that passed a few years ago really stepped in that direction to have less penalty on drug abusers who really are populating the jails and the prisons. If you go into the jail or the prison, the majority of the people there have some type of substance use disorder and mental health condition. But so there's more of a focus on dangerous criminals going into the criminal justice system and forcing people down in their criminal justice involvement. But also, as a part of that, there was a significant investment in treatment services. And we have been moving in that direction, but we're not Portugal. But it is a step in the right direction.
I think that decriminalization is a huge piece. Like you mentioned, that why don't we get people treatment instead of locking them up? It's a really sad reality out there right now, and I can tell you countless times that moms and dads and family members have called me talking about what's it going to take to get my kid arrested so I can get him treatment. Yeah. And the fact that that's how our system is set up now is obviously something that we have to deal with. I would imagine you probably have better numbers than I do, but the number one referral into treatment source in our state is the criminal justice system. It's not docs, it's not families, it's so... I'm hopeful that it will keep going that way. We're probably a ways from Portugal, but I'm hopeful that it'll keep going that ways.
We are. I just add that, and I agree with Adam, we're actually known across the country as a leader in that movement, which surprises a lot of people. Sure. That a red state like Utah, The Economist came out to do a report on Utah because we were kind of leading that charge in at least lowering the penalties, the increase in drug courts, which allows people who have been arrested to at least get that off their record if they go through treatment programs. And get the focus where it needs to be. Not only, and I love this, and I say it all the time, as Adam did, not only is it the right thing to do, but it's also the fiscally conservative thing to do, and that's a good way to sell things to a very red legislature, is it will save us taxpayer dollars if we get people the treatment they need and we're
which is how
that.
Needle exchange ultimately went through, too, is it fiscally makes sense. It's the correct thing to do, but it's the fiscally smart thing to do.
We can only build so many prisons and jails, and we're doing way too much of that. So next, whoever's got the microphone.
I was wondering if there's any focus on providing and incentivizing alternative forms of pain control that are like non-opioid based or non-medication based, and how you can really incentivize that on a policy level.
You know, there is. We do know, I work with a lot of the providers in the state, and one of the barriers they do face is getting coverage for some of that. A lot of times it's hard to get insurance coverage for some of those alternative treatments as well. Scott, let's pick on Scott.
Get an answer over here. Thanks, Scott.
I'll pick on you.
So, yeah, I'm Scott Whittle, medical director at Select Health, one of the insurance companies. And one of our challenges is that we get told what our benefit is supposed to look like by most of our stakeholders. My Medicaid product, my Medicare product, they get mandated to me. So what we need a discussion about best strategies that are evidence-based so that we can then put that into our benefit to offer it to folks to get the right care at the right time. One of the other challenges we face is that, you know, if you look at the big group of people that need access to treatment, a lot of them live within government programs. Most of those programs have high deductibles. If you put it into my world, I'm told you all have to have high deductibles. You know what that means if you need opiate treatment, is that basically comes out of your pocket, because you're talking about a group of people who are generally healthy with some mental health conditions, some social determinants of wellness issues like education, jobs, and housing, and they have an addiction that's going to be kind of costly to treat on the front end. And if their deductible is $5,000, how is it that I'm supposed to support them in getting that done? So discussions that I would love to hear us have are, how can we frame the benefit that the person has, the medical health benefit, to fit the kind of needs they're likely to have so that we can do the right thing? We don't price people out of treatment inadvertently.
Well, and I think, too, why don't we have better coverage for physical therapy and massage on the front end? Like, why is it that we have to immediately, I can write opiates every day, yeah, till the cow come home, and no one will ever question me. I can write someone 10 massage therapy sessions, then their benefit's done. So on that side too, I think there is some, clearly some rethinking that's needed.
Yeah. And you can see the layers to all of this, right? We've talked about, and this goes back to just the way our medical system is designed, from insurers to doctors to pharmacists, and how everyone has a role to play in this. Yeah. And it starts at the policy level. Next question, please.
Thanks. This question is also for Jen. I wondered if you could comment on the two studies that were published yesterday in JAMA Internal Medicine. You're probably actually all familiar with these, about the state-level policies on marijuana and how those may influence opioid prescription numbers and deaths, and how those data.
I have to be totally honest with you. I have not seen yesterday's JAMA yet. I did sleep 2 hours last night, though. I apologize.
You.
I didn't stay up to read those studies during that.
I haven't read
I can't comment on it because I haven't read those studies specifically.
Would you be willing to comment on what is known then prior to yesterday's studies about state level data about marijuana policies and opioid prescriptions and opioid deaths?
Well, I'm happy to jump in just on the marijuana issue.
Right.
I think this is a hugely important issue about the safety of marijuana and its effectiveness in dealing with pain in a way that does not cause the same addictions and the same all of the problems we've been talking about. Right. I think there's general consensus around that it's better than opioids. At least we're getting there. The question is, what does that marijuana policy look like? And we're having this debate right now in the state of Utah, right? We've had, over the last 3 years, we have had significant legislation proposed in the legislature to deal with medical marijuana, and none of that has passed. Which I think is very unfortunate. I'm going to editorialize a little bit right here. There were bills that were being discussed, that were being voted on, that the governor actually would have signed. This year we did get the first one signed. It is a right to try end of life bill. You know, if you've got 6 months to live, you're going to be able to get this, and your doctor prescribes it. Okay, so it's a very small part. But there is a ballot initiative that is going on the ballot right now. The signatures have been gathered. They're still gathering. They've been submitted to my office. We oversee the elections. We feel pretty confident that of the now 5 ballot initiatives that are out there, that this one is definitely going to make it. We think they have enough signatures. We're still counting to make sure they got the signatures in the right places. But we think it'll be on there, and it will give citizens then a chance to vote and support that. And here's where it gets really interesting, though. It's so complicated. If it's just a, do you support medical marijuana or not, then, you know, that's the discussion. Do you support this policy versus 50 other iterations of this one? That's where the governor and legislators are starting to see things a little differently. So I think we all agree that medical marijuana is going to happen here in the state of Utah, and that it is at least a piece of dealing with the opioid epidemic. What medical marijuana looks like, and the science behind it, we've made a huge mistake, and I'm still very upset at the Obama administration for not changing the scheduling of it from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule II drug. It was unacceptable, and they supported it, and they should have done it, and they could have done it, and that's one of the problems we're having. I mean, it is still illegal, even if we. And if some states have done this, we know, even if they do make it legal, just being able to transact for that medical marijuana, it has to be done in cash because our banking institutions can't traffic in this stuff because it's still a Schedule I drug. And so this is where we need some just significant changes at the federal level and at the state level so we can get it done and get it done right now. This may pass in Utah. Right now it's very, very popular. The latest polling we've seen, about 70% say they support medical marijuana. The problem is, I can tell you, if this gets on the ballot and the details of this policy really start getting out, down to minute details, a lot of that support's going to go away because it makes it look a little too much like the potential for recreational marijuana down the road, and can people grow their own if they're not within 100 miles of a dispensary, or if dispensaries aren't online by 2020. The devil's really in the details on this one, but I'm hoping, pass or no pass, the legislature does this and gets it right really soon, and 2 years ago would have been great. So, sorry, I've spent too much time.
No, I thank you. And we have the data that's come out, for example, with children with Dravet's and cannabis being used in seizures and intractable seizures. I've seen these kids. I've taken care of these kids. It's phenomenal what it's done for them.
It works.
And so the hope is that we can move forward to get people better, different options. But we got a ways to go to get there, right?
We do.
I agree with
you. And I will tell you, the governor told me today before I left, he said, if you go and they ask about marijuana, please tell them, I support medical marijuana. I don't support the details of this bill. There are some real problems with it. But I do support getting it done and getting it done the right way so doctors can actually start prescribing this the way they're prescribing opioids right now, only in a, you know, again, in a much more responsible way. And I'm getting the sign that we are done. I know we have so many other questions out there. Thank you. We will be, again, we'll be around. We want to hear from you. We want to talk with you. Any final just thoughts? And if you want to give out your
contact information. Yeah, quick, I was just going to say, we have naloxone kits here for anyone who would like to have one. I can do a quick education on how to use it, or there are online options as well. We have a training April 5th coming up for anyone who wants to learn how to use naloxone or learn how to dispense naloxone. There's flyers about that. You may think you may never need it. Odds are decent that you could need it. So please equip yourself if you're willing. Thank you.
Anything else, guys?
Yeah, just my last piece would be about stigma and talk about addiction, talk about mental health. If we talk about it, I mean, that really is the biggest fence you can put in front of all of this.
Yeah, piggyback off of that, talk with your friends and your family about these issues. And if you ever need any assistance, please reach out to Odyssey House, and we'd be happy to help you navigate this terrible situation. So.
Yeah, and I just want to close with an exclamation point on what Angela just said, and that is with stigma. We've been talking a lot about suicide. You know, we could spend another session very similar to this and what's happening there, and it would surprisingly be a very similar conversation. The stigma with mental health and addiction has got to change in this state. We can't solve the problem until we bring it out into the light and let people know that we care about them, that we love them, that we want to get them the help, that we're not interested in locking them up. We're really interested in getting them the treatment they need. And I think that conversation is really starting to change things. It's changing the legislature. Again, what's happening with bills that have been passed, not with needle exchange, with some of the preventative measures. We really are doing a decent job here, but we can do better. And it starts with stigma across the board. So please help us spread the message. Thanks again to our panelists. Let's give them a round of applause.
You can find a full recording of this panel, which focused on efforts to combat the opioid epidemic in Utah, at our website, kcpw.org. And this program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. Thank you for listening.